Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Some of you, no doubt, remember that in Garrison Killier's anecdotal Lake Wobegon, the city of his fictional creation, all the children are above average. Now, that mathematical impossibility happens to match the spirit of the age with so many parents who are absolutely convinced that their children are above average, but on the other side of that, you can see a real trend in the culture with the fact that very few teachers actually now give Fs. Very few professors ever flunk a paper, flunk an exam, or flunk a student. Very few failures actually happen when it comes to the lives of children and young adults. They've been raised in a situation in which failure has been prevented by the intervention of others or by the recalibration of standards or by the fact that it's just taken out of the vocabulary as a possibility. We're going to be talking about a world without failure. We're going to be looking at some very interesting data indicating that American parents are now intervening in the lives of their children as if they are now taking the tests, writing the papers, as if they are now becoming the attorneys to be advocates for their children in terms of relationships with professors and school authorities, as if they are now finishing the model rather than letting the kid make the model himself. It's probably a pattern that has very long rootage, but it's something that is certainly coming to attention today. And as we're going to see from an article in the Wall Street Journal just posted today, an incredible number of these parents are now, even as their children reach the ages of young adulthood, refusing to let them fail even financially. They're bailing their children out time and time and time again. At least some parents have said, enough is enough. And we'll be talking about that later today on the Albert Mohler Program. First, to review some issues in the news. And by the way, here in Louisville, Kentucky, the news is ice. An ice storm has descended upon north central Kentucky, southern Indiana, and other parts of this region. And it's very interesting to see that even as people pretty much figure they can cope with snow, no one, it seems, assumes you can cope with ice. And so streets are closed, schools closed early, even businesses began sending people home. And so in light of the fact that a winter storm has come, there is an enormous stillness out there, which you don't hear too many days in the work week like this. All right, some of the issues in the news. The New York Times reports that most children now still live in two-parent homes. This is a report from the Census Bureau. What makes this interesting is that it appears that some of the transformation of the family structure that has been certainly noted during the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and now into the 21st century appears to have leveled off. The comparable figures in 2004 were only slightly different than that now in 2008. And again, this shows some leveling off. Overall, 7 in 10 children live with two parents. About two-thirds live with two married parents, and about 6 to 10 live with both biological parents. Now, tie that to the article I posted at my website just yesterday at albertmohler.com, having to do with the fact that it's either parents or prisons. That what happens when you have unparented children is that an inordinate number of them end up in prison, where, especially in the case of many young males, they actually for the first time meet an authority that says no and makes it stick. Well, let me point out that one of the most haunting aspects of this report from the Census Bureau reported on today is that even as 7 out of 10 children live with their two parents, when you look across the demographic spectrum, it's anything but even. Let me just read to you directly from the story. This is by Sam Roberts in today's edition of the New York Times. Quote, the proportion who lived with two parents varied widely by race and ethnicity. 87% of Asians, 78% of non-Hispanic whites, 68% of Hispanics, and 38% of blacks. So there you have a very, very wide spectrum from Asians, for whom it is said now that 87% of children live with two parents, to African Americans, only 38%. Little footnote here, among the nearly 19 million children living with their unmarried biological mothers, 18% were living in households where the mother had a partner. So even as you're looking at this with two parents, it's not exactly still the Ozzie and Harriet picture that is so often lampooned. It's not the picture of the natural family, which should be held up as our standard, it is something very, very different. But perhaps there is at least some good news in the fact that some of these trends appeared to have leveled off. Reports coming out of Indiana that a proposed ban to prevent same-sex marriage has died in the Indiana House of Representatives. Supporters of a constitutional ban on same-sex marriages will have to wait at least another 4 years because a key House leader in Indiana decided that he would not consider legislation that had already passed in the Senate. Big setback there for those who would hope to see Indiana join the more than 30 states now that have adopted either a statute or a constitutional amendment that would prevent same-sex marriage. Transgender issues have been rather constantly in the news in recent days in Montgomery County, Maryland, and seems that time and time again we're back to Montgomery County, Maryland. That's the location of the very intense sex education controversy just in recent months. But now the Baltimore Sun's reporting that a Montgomery County measure intended to protect transgender people appears headed for a voter referendum. Now, what's interesting about this is that proponents of the effort to pass these provisions that would, in some sense, here at least, quote, protect transgender people, end quote, did not want this to become a referendum. They did not want it to have to go before the public because this will lead, indeed, to a controversy and conflict. Let me read to you from the article. It says here, the recently passed law protects transgender people from discrimination in housing, employment, public accommodations, and taxi and cable service, and was supposed to go into effect yesterday, but it is on hold after opponents gathered 32,000 signatures in a bid to put it on the ballot this fall. So, in other words, this is a state that, much like what is found in some parts of California, allows citizens an opportunity to call for a referendum when even the legislature has adopted a measure that is considered not in the interest of the public. So that's very interesting. But just consider the fact that 32,000 signatures is a fairly high threshold. So it says something that at least 32,000 citizens in Montgomery County, Maryland, decided that something needed to be done here. Now, I'm going to read to you another statement from this article in the Baltimore Sun, because this is one of those revealing statements that tells us something about the challenge that lies before us. Quote, once viewed as a relatively straightforward matter of biological category, gender has evolved into a far more complicated subject. Transgender is an umbrella term that can include transsexuals as well as people with a fluid identity that transcends traditional gender categories, end quote. Now, if you're looking for one short summary statement that really does encapsulate the challenge before us with the transgender movement, you can't do better than that one. When it says that it includes transsexuals and those who've had surgery and biological reassignment, et cetera, but also, and I want to read you that phrase once again, listen to this, people with a fluid identity that transcends traditional gender categories. Now, what do you do with that? How in the world does the law come up with some way of understanding that? Do we have now male, female, and other? You know, those who are the proponents of this legislation say it's just to give people their rights not to be the objects and subjects of discrimination. But when you look at it closely, you realize, just as with the California legislation we recently discussed, there appears to be no real and genuinely rational way to even look at how this could be codified. If you're just talking about a fluid category that transcends all traditional concepts of gender, then what's left? The issue of transgender also has come into controversy in New Jersey because even as that state has adopted a new civil union law, advocates for transgender persons say that it, quote, creates a second-class status for same-sex couples, and it is particularly vexing for people who are transgendered because they are not adequately covered, say advocates, in the New Jersey legislation. Since the law took effect, 2,329 New Jersey couples have entered into civil unions in the state, and 56 more have affirmed their unions from other states. We'll be watching that with you. It's just another reminder of how this issue is escalating before our eyes. Something that was hardly on the political cultural map a matter of just 5 or 6 years ago. It was discussed, but it wasn't a matter of legislation and the kind of urgent concern you find now. It is now front burner in many communities. The Wall Street Journal, in its Work and Family article, sometimes comes out with some of the most amazing stuff. And especially when you consider that the readers of the Wall Street Journal are a fairly thin demographic slice of the United States. You're talking about those who are highly involved in business executives, and in finance and all the rest. Now, Sue Schnellenberger who writes the Work and Family column for the Wall Street Journal, says that there is now a brat race. And it works like this. We've been talking about these neurotic parents who are so concerned to get their children in just the right preschool that they're willing even to stand in line, cut in line. They're willing to bribe and do many things. You've seen certainly the news coverage from New York and elsewhere. Now we are told that it is becoming routine in some circles to enroll children before they are born. As soon as the couple finds out they're pregnant, why, the mom has to get in line to make sure that this prospective child, whatever it may be, whatever its name may eventually be, will be enrolled in just the right school at just the right time, lest he be a failure in life. But then again, failure seems to be impossible. That's what we're going to be talking about today on the Albert Mueller Program. Right back with your calls.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. You know, if you gain entry into one of the service academies of the United States military, whether it be the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, Annapolis, this is the U.S. Naval Academy or the U.S. Military Academy, at West Point, one of the things that is said to those who enter those academies on the very first day is that you, by the very fact that you are here, have done well. You have probably never experienced failure. You have been at the top of your class. You've been at the top of your team. You've been recognized for stellar achievement. That's how you got here. But over the next year, you are going to fail. You are going to fail repeatedly. You are going to fail in such a way that you'll fail in front of your classmates. You're going to fail, and you are going to learn from failing. Now, the U.S. military academies believe that failure is a necessary lesson for life. In other words, if all a person knows is success or apparent success, then all they're going to know are the lessons learned from success and not some of the absolutely necessary lessons that come from failure. Now, if you work backward from that mentality, the service academies, which was, frankly, a mentality that was rather pervasive through the culture in terms of career, in terms of education, in terms of parenting, and you work back to where we are today, we're living in a culture in which failure is a foreign concept, especially for children and young people. Now, let's track that out just a little bit. If you look at grade inflation as an issue, you will note the fact that in America's colleges and universities, almost all of the students receive A's and B's. In fact, you don't have to do spectacularly well to get a B, because B is now considered more or less as average, when B, by definition, when you have grades A, B, C, D, and F, is supposed to be above average. It's supposed to reflect achievement above the norm. But now a B is considered failure by many students. It's the least grade that can be acceptable, no matter how one performs on a test. Now, the teachers used to use something called a bell curve in order to establish a grading pattern. Well, that's just out the window, because now there is no curve. There is no pattern other than how many A's and how many B's. And right now, even the Ivy League universities are admitting there is a scandal in the fact that all of their students tend to be extremely high achieving, even after they get among only fellow high achievers. And no one even says anymore that there's a norm, there's an average. Everyone has to be above average. Now, you don't have to be a whiz at statistics to know that it's impossible for everyone to be above average. Otherwise, the whole concept of average loses any meaning. But if someone's going to be average and someone's going to be above average, then someone has to be below average. If you're looking at grades, if there are A's, there must be F's. Well, what we have right now is a situation in which, in our psychotherapeutic worldview, we consider such things to be very toxic to self-esteem. And frankly, when you have the intervention of parents in so much of the process, you now have parents acting like attorneys, if indeed they're not actually hiring attorneys, to make very clear that their child is and must be above average, probably far above average, probably even far above the others who are far above average. Failure is just not an option. Now, when it comes to grades, this is now so pervasive that it is now just a scandal that is public and known, and no one seems to know what to do about it. But it's now also true for sports and in many athletic endeavors where children can't fail. There are no outs. No one can strike out. You can't possibly not perform really well. Everyone gets a trophy. It's also true in finances. It's also true in personal matters of dealing with money. Terry Cullen, writing the Fiscally Fit column in the Wall Street Journal today, mentions that many parents are routinely bailing their children, even their grandchildren, out of repeated financial failure. And this is something that seems to be a real pattern with the baby boom generation. Children get into trouble. They make bad investments. They waste their money. They get into credit card problems. They pile up debt, and they can count upon parents to dig them out. Now, the catalyst for the article by Terry Cullen is the fact that as many baby boomer parents age, they are less and less able to fulfill the pattern they themselves started. In other words, they find themselves in a financial situation in which they cannot safely bail their own children out of their problems. And some parents have had enough. In particular, again, Terry Cullen, writing an article about her mother, says her mother realized when a granddaughter called for financial help to bail her out after the granddaughter's father, that is, the woman's son, had already called. This is one lady that said she had had enough. I'm reading from the article. This mother also acknowledged that by allowing her kids to depend upon her financially, she dented her own finances. She had established this pattern. The first step, according to Ms. Cullen, for her mother was to acknowledge her own inclinations when her children turned to her for support. Too often, my mom admitted, my brothers and sister would turn to her to vent about problems. She'd offer to help without being asked. That behavior had to stop. This really says a whole lot about us. We simply cannot admit the fact that our children at times might fail, and frankly might need to fail, in order to learn the lessons of failure. To join the conversation, call me at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We all want to shield our children from the rough patches, from the hard experiences, from tragedy and from hurt. But at times, if they're going to grow, they've got to learn some lessons from failure. The number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. How did we get ourselves in this situation where we expect everyone to be above average and we'll do whatever is necessary, including not only being advocates, but assistants to our own children to make sure that doesn't happen? Let's go to Beth calling from Bardstown, Kentucky. Go ahead, Beth.
Good afternoon, Dr. Mueller. Thank you for taking my call. I am both a professor and a parent, so I have seen both sides of this issue in my home and in my classroom. Because my daughter spent the majority of their teenage years watching me go through school and working on my homework, it became very clear to them that I wasn't going to be able to do their homework for them, and that we each had jobs to do, and that was homework, schoolwork, and we sat around the table together and did our work. And because of my schedule and because of my philosophy about their work being their work and my work being my work, many times I wouldn't go to school and bring half-completed assignments or something that they had forgotten, and there'd be a lot of tears involved. But I think what happened through all of that is maybe what they learned is that not only were their failures their responsibility, but their successes were also theirs as well. And they watched me and saw me go through the same thing as this student. And I'm always shocked when I start my classrooms and at the beginning of the school year and the semester, and I inevitably will have a couple of students who will approach me with this absolutely incredible attitude of that they are starting out in my class with an A. And that basically I, as a professor, am doing something to stand in the way of them getting an A, as opposed to the idea of everyone walking into the classroom with a blank slate. And whatever grade that they get at the end of the semester is the grade that they earned.
You know, Beth, you're describing something that is pervasive in higher academia, higher education, and it's fascinating to have your first-person testimony on this. There are people who now say, I'm an A person, and I get A's. And it's not even really about personal achievement. It's about just kind of a personal claim of self-identity. And I really appreciate you speaking both as professor and as mom, Beth. It's great to hear from you there in Bardstown, Kentucky. To join the conversation, call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. You also have, of course, if you've got children and are looking at students in higher education, colleges and universities, we now have the phenomenon of the helicopter parent who, is right with the student in every decision, every test, every paper. We'll be right back.
Listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. It is fascinating to see this water come down and see it freeze on the ground. It's just another phenomenon. You know, growing up in Florida, I never had to worry about this. But it's fascinating how ice can shut a city down. But it hasn't shut down conversation on the Albert Mohler Program. To join the conversation, call us at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We are talking today about how we have conspired together, especially as parents, to make it impossible for our children to fail when actually they need to fail and they need to know they failed in order to learn the necessary lessons of failure. Let's go to Dana, listening on WFIA, calling from New Albany, Indiana. Go ahead, Dana.
Hi. It's really good to speak with you. I listen quite often when I'm sitting on my computer. And I just wanted to say that I'm a parent of a 17-year-old who is an average student, and I've let her know that it's okay to be average, that you can't be perfect all the time. And I'm also a preschool teacher. And I think that the schools, from the very beginning, from the time that our children enter school, I think that they're setting these children up for failure. Although I think that it's a very good system, the school system, it just... They don't tell the children what they're doing wrong a lot of times. It's more of, oh, that's good, that's great.
Yeah.
It may not be right, but that's great. You made such a good effort, and that's good too. But how are they going to learn?
Yeah.
If they're not told,
that's,
you know,
right,
you didn't make that A right. Let's try it like this.
You know, I really appreciate that, Dana, because when you think about it, let's just take math for an example. If they think 2 plus 2 equals 5, that's not good. And if they keep consistently suggesting that 2 plus 2 equals 5, they're going to have big problems in life. Telling them that that's great and that they're doing well when they're obviously missing the key concept is not helping them at all. Poe Bronson wrote an article just several months ago on how the self-esteem movement in education is really hurting children, because you have educators telling children you're doing well when actually the child knows he's not doing well. And that's very confusing and demoralizing. Thanks for your call, Dana. Let's go to Sean in Grand Island, Nebraska, listening on KMMJ. Go ahead, Sean.
Oh, Albert Mohler. I can echo that same fact. I've got quadruplets at home. I've got one of them that's extremely gifted, and I've got two of them that are lagging back a little bit. And I just got done coming back from parent-teachers conferences, and I had to fight getting a little sarcastic with them. And I'd like to have my kids go into a private parochial school, but having four kids of the same age is a little bit of a tie on our finances. But anyway, she told me, I asked them about possibly doing summer school or possibly holding one or two of them back, which, you know, I know it would adversely affect them, having two of them go on to first grade and then two of them stay back in kindergarten. But I asked them what are the possibilities with that, and they said, well, as long as your child has an IEP, which is an individualized education program. And I'm sure you remember when you were in college, when I was in college, I had an IEP. And if you didn't meet your standards, if you didn't live up to the expectations and at least get above a certain grade in a class, you were held back and had to take that class over again. And I said, you know, not to sound sarcastic, but is this what we're living in when it comes to no child being left behind? Is that what that truly means?
You know, that's fascinating, Sean. And you have a very unique context in which to make this decision. But I'll tell you, it's clear. I'm the father. My wife and I are the parents of a 15-year-old boy And we've had to make different decisions for him than we had for his older sister, simply because boys mature sometimes more slowly. Certainly when they're very young, they don't adapt to the school environment quite so well as others. Sean, I have to ask you, of these quadruplets, and we're all just absolutely in awe of this now, are they boys or girls, and how old are they?
They're all boys, and the real blessing I have is they were born on my birthday as well.
That's incredible. How old are they now?
They're five.
Well, God bless you, Sean. I'm so thankful that you're their dad, and you're concerned in just the right way about the fact that you want them actually to be tied to an objective standard of achievement so they'll actually know how they're doing. And, you know, with your involvement in their lives, just as is evidenced in this conversation, you know, they've got a real advantage that other kids that age don't have. But right now, I can tell you there are an awful lot of Americans around there imagining the blessings that you have as having quadruplet boys age five. My guess is you don't end the day with a whole lot of surplus energy, at least not as mom or as dad. But we really appreciate your call. You know, when you start thinking about this kind of situation, the one that Sean described in the conversation with the teacher, you realize that there's an entire system, an entire culture, an entire set of perceptions that conspires against reality here and really does try to make failure an impossibility. We'll be right back.
Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mohler Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. You know, the lessons of failure are often very, very important. And just to use some historical examples, think of the rise of science and technology, and think of a figure like Thomas Alva Edison. Edison was famous for saying that success was the child of innumerable failures. I mean, just look at how he had to try just about everything in creating the incandescent light bulb. He had to try hundreds of things that didn't work until he found that one thing that did. And that's true for many of the inventions that we take for granted in everyday life. It didn't work the first time. It was produced by successive failures. And the same thing is true in many other areas of life as well. You simply don't know what's going on. You don't know what's going to work. You don't know who you are sometimes until failure takes place. Warren Bennis, the specialist in leadership, tells the story of a major CEO that had a vice president who, in terms of a business adventure, lost several million dollars in terms of a new product line or a new system, and it completely was judged to be a failure. And as a matter of fact, it was one of those failures that just stinks up a whole financial report and became something of a scandal in the company. And the vice president came and offered his resignation, said, I'm going to quit because I was the father of this great failure. And the CEO of the business said, I'm not going to let you quit. He said, we just invested X millions of dollars in this lesson, and you're the only man that learned that lesson, and you're going to stay here until we figure out what is going to work. And, you know, that's just another great example. In the military world, history is replete with stories of failures who became great in terms of the lessons they learned. Two of those, certainly from the Civil War, include Ulysses S. Grant and Abraham Lincoln. When you just consider Abraham Lincoln's political failures until he was elected president of the United States, he probably learned far more from those failures than he would have from successes. He would have become an inside Washington figure rather than becoming the great president that history records him to be. Ulysses S. Grant was washed up. His first military exploits were judged to be failures. And yet he became the general who certainly held the key to victory for the Northern armies during the Civil War. You can look at very similar things. I mean, people do not remember that Dwight David Eisenhower's first military adventure in North Africa was not, certainly in the first stages, a success. And yet he became Supreme Commander of Allied Forces and, of course, the architect of the great victory against the Third Reich in World War II. Now, writ small in individual lives, it's pretty much the same way. There are people today who are great successes in different fields of life, and what's different is it's not the field they entered as young adults. They were failures in one field only to become a great success somewhere else. They didn't know who they were. They didn't know what their talents were. until they found out. Now, here's what really concerns me. We have all of these children whose parents have cocooned them in an environment in which failure is just unthinkable. And so parents conspired, even when the children are not performing, even when the children are actually failing, we cosmetically and in terms of manipulation make it appear to be something else. Here is the real problem. The lesson that child learns, the lesson that young adult learns, is that I can't fail. I must be pretty good at this. My parents tell me I am. My teacher in the educational system tells me I am. And unfortunately, that child never learns until some point when it's too late that it was all a lie. And it simply wasn't true. And especially in the academic world, I can say as a seminary and college president, it's deadly dangerous for students not to know what they really are able to excel in and what, in terms of subject matter and in terms of academic projects, they're just not cut out for. You know, that needs to be learned earlier in life, not so late. It certainly would be helpful to learn some of those lessons when they are not so spectacularly expensive, as happens when people are told something that isn't true, and they get out in the real world, and it's very different. Let me tell you what the real world is like. The moment a child graduates from the academic world and goes into the work world, he shifts or she shifts from a situation in which it's all about them and about them doing well into a situation in which, by and large, it's all about the bottom line. And now, all of a sudden, there's an objective standard. If you contribute to the bottom line, you stay. If you contribute really well to the bottom line, you advance. But if you do not contribute, and it does not go well, then there are a lot of people standing in line to take your job. And that's what's really different. That is the cold, hard reality that many young people are just not ready for because their parents have coddled them. Now, let's bring this into a Christian worldview perspective for just a moment. We as Christian parents need to recognize that we do live in a Genesis 3 world. And in a Genesis 3 world, that is a sinful world, we're going to find a mixture of failure and success. We're going to find human beings at their best, and we're going to find human beings at their worst. And we are the people who are supposed to be unsurprised by the fact that, for instance, you have to work in order to advance. That there is a clear teaching in Scripture about the importance of working hard, the virtue of diligence, and the reward of a job well done. When you subvert that mentality, and instead when you tell people that they deserve to do well, we especially tell our children that they deserve to do well simply because they're so important, and because they're ours, and because they're just good, then we're lying to them. We need to teach them that they will actually have to work hard, that they will have to strive, that they will have to sacrifice, that they will have to apply themselves, that they will have to study. And at times, they're going to discover that they're not equally good at everything. Not all of us are concert pianists. Not all of us can hit, a major league home run. Very few, as a matter of fact, can do those things. Very few will become CEOs of Fortune 500 corporations. Very few will become the winning race car drivers in the Formula 500 circuit. Very few will actually become world-renowned heart surgeons. But the world's not just made up of those who hold positions and have jobs and fulfill roles that take special talents that the entire world envies. Every single person is given gifts. That's another part of the Christian worldview. God has a purpose for every single person. And for all those who come to know the Lord Jesus Christ as Savior, God not only has a purpose for their lives for eternity, but has a purpose for their lives on this planet. And a part of what we need to do as parents is what we need to do in the church. And that is call out the gifts in every single human being and help them find out where they can make the greatest contribution to the glory of God. If we transform the equation that way, we'll understand that sometimes we have to learn by failure what we are not called to do, or at least what we're going to have to work harder at doing, in order to find out exactly what God has called us to do, and that which we can do most fully to His glory. Back with final thoughts in just a moment. Coast to coast and with listeners around the world, this is the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. All eyes tonight will be in Austin, Texas, where the Democratic candidates, Senator Hillary Clinton and Senator Barack Obama, will be having a very much touted debate, one-on-one. And this situation comes as the political dynamic is narrowing to the extent that Hillary Clinton has to win Texas if she has any hope whatsoever of gaining the Democratic nomination for president. 10 straight primary and caucus victories by Barack Obama has now put, that string has put Hillary Clinton in a vice, politically speaking, and even the authorities in her own campaign are admitting that if she doesn't win in Texas and win big, it's pretty much gone as a possibility for her to gain the Democratic nomination. Now, that raises the stakes for the debate tonight, because especially as the media will frame the reality, this debate is going to be what will set up the dynamic for the election. Now, the voting doesn't come until the 4th of March, but that's now, you just watch the clock ticking, that's now less than 2 weeks away. And so we are looking at the end of this very, very long primary season, and it's only long because it seems like it's gone on forever. And we will have the nominees for both parties in all likelihood by the time you get to the 4th of March. If not, it'll be on the Democratic side that there is still a question. And at that point, the question really becomes very controversial for that party, very difficult, because then you have different constituencies within the Democratic Party that will be pitted against each other. So watch the debate tonight. And one of the interesting things to watch is to see how Hillary Clinton, as a candidate, will try to reset the entire equation over against Senator Obama. Because if she does not reset the equation, she is going to lose. And so everything tonight is really going to come down to the drama of seeing how one candidate will try to reset the debate. And it'll be very interesting to see how that happens. You know, the line she's been using of late has been the choice between speeches and solutions. Between the kind of promises that Senator Obama gives and the kind of policies that she proposes. Well, thus far, the American people have not shown that they are buying that argument. So it'll be interesting to see tonight if there's a new argument. Tomorrow we're going to be discussing something very, very interesting. It relates to an article I wrote at my website at albertmueller.com, published just earlier this week. It's based upon research done by Poe Bronson, published in New York Magazine, having to do with how children learn to lie. In my estimation, his article in New York Magazine is one of the most important I've seen in a very long time for parents and for anyone interested in children to really come to terms with how children learn to lie. And the subtext of this is very, very important. He argues that they learn to lie from parents. It's a conversation we need to have. We'll have it tomorrow on the Albert Mueller Program. I'll meet you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmueller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmueller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.